from behind his grandson. Soane wanted to know if he could count on the agreements he'd made with Lan to be the final word from the clan. My grandfather is not his old self, but he is still well and enjoying his much-deserved retirement. Soane touched his soft, meaty hands to his forehead in salute. Chapter 15. A Bargain with Demons. Outside the warehouse stood a dozen souped-up Toroyo motorcycles in the garish neon shades preferred by John Loon's Northside bikers. Violent red, lime green, electric blue. Hilo paused to admire a couple of them, patting the contoured leather seat of a particularly striking vehicle, bending to examine the gleaming engine and peering briefly over the dash before continuing on to the aluminum door of the repurposed building, which vibrated with the pounding bass of loud music. With him were Make Tar and two senior fingers that Hilo hoped to soon promote to fists. The clever but slightly pudgy and unassuming Obu had better deflection than anyone Hilo had ever met, but needed to learn how to command if he was to advance. The other finger, Een, had no especially superlative jade talent, but like many female greenbones, particularly on the horn side of the clan, she was accustomed to working harder than her male counterparts, which Hilo appreciated. Een Ro and Make Tar were an on-again, off-again relationship, which was currently off. They were too similar, and as lovers, they fought like cats. The four greenbones strode into the motorcycle gang's headquarters. Roughly 20 bikers, almost all between the ages of 16 and 25, were sprawled on battered old sofas, drinking and smoking, some shooting pool, a few watching television. Three men were openly counting a pile of money in one corner. Hilo looked around with interest. As far as gangs in the Coinwash district went, the Chrome Demons maintained one of the better equipped and appointed abodes, with relatively less filth, vermin, and drugged indolence. All eyes turned to the intruders. A second later, every member of the Chrome Demons was on his feet, hands going for guns and knives and whatever other weapons were on hand. Bottles, pool cues. The trio of men in the corner jumped up and tried, amusingly, to hide the large stack of money behind them. Tar shouted, "Listen up, curs!" Someone shut off the music. "Who owns the beautiful fire-red Toroyo RP-550 out front?" Hilo asked. "I do," came a reply from the back of the room. A surly man stepped forward. He was heavily built and, typical for his gang, wore a leather jacket with the sleeves sliced into tatters. His thick hair was styled into two stiff and vaguely phallic humps on his head. He appeared a few years older than most of the youths around him, and Hilo deduced from his superior vehicle and his authoritative swagger that he was the leader of this cell of demons. "What do you value more, your face or your bike?" Hilo asked him. "What?" growled the man uncomprehendingly. "Your face or your bike?" Hilo repeated. "Which do you choose?" The man's eyes flicked down to the jade studs visible across Hilo's collarbone, and then over at Make, Obu, and Een. "My face," he said hesitantly. Instantly, Hilo struck him, breaking his nose. The man fell back, eyes streaming, stunned with pain. He hadn't even had time to raise his hands in defense. A few of the younger demons, who were less wise to the world, made sudden moves to unload their pistols, but before a single shot could be fired, Obu flung a deflection that hurled every member of the gang back against the walls and caused the sofas and heavy pool table to skid out of place. As the Chrome Demons staggered back to their feet, Hilo said reasonably, "We've heard many complaints about the noise and disorderliness of street racing in this neighborhood. Also, the number of robberies is getting out of hand. It's obvious from such fine rides parked outside that the Chrome Demons are not short on money. So it's only fair you criminals should pay tribute to the clan that takes care of the law-abiding people you so carelessly inconvenience. As Hilo spoke, Een walked the warehouse floor with a large canvas bag, collecting the ample pile of cash from the back table and confiscating guns with business-like efficiency. With Make and Obu watching every move, no one dared put up an additional fight. The Chrome Demons were a rough lot, with street-hardened, tattooed, glowering killers among them. But many of them rapidly handed over their weapons and money in resignation. They'd obviously been fined by Greenbones before, and understood that they were guaranteed to get out alive if they cooperated, and guaranteed not to if they didn't. Clan oversight of every aspect of society, including crime, was largely accepted as part of life in John Loon. One foolish man leered at Een, but she turned such an eagerly murderous look on him that he stopped contritely and emptied his pockets before she could break any of his bones. Hilo was pleased with both of his fingers. So far they had taken their cues from him and applied the proper amount of force. Neither had overreacted, yet no one in the room questioned they would shed blood without hesitation. It was a tricky balance that a Greenbone had to strike. Een came back and set the bag of weapons and money on the ground at Hilo's feet. "Normally," he said, "I would take your ill-acquired gains and leave you with the warning that if I heard more complaints, I would send you and your bikes to the bottom of the harbor. But that's something I could have sent any of my fists to do. It's not why I'm here."
"Why the fuck are you here?"
slurred the leader, holding his face.
"Good of you to ask," said Hilo. "You know of Three-Fingered G?"
"G's dead,"
someone in the room called out.
"Feeding the worms," Hilo agreed. "The man who killed him works for the Mountain. I'm sure of it. But I want to know how. I want to know what he's doing and who he's working with. A lot of this," Hilo nudged the sack of money and guns with his foot, "comes from the brewing and selling of street shine to jade thieves and smugglers. The sort of folks that buy and trade with black market carvers like Tem Ben. So here's my offer. Follow your contacts. Your thieves and pickpockets, your shine dealers and pimps. Do it quietly. Find me Tem Ben and as many of those who work with him as you can, and I'll walk out, leaving this bag on the floor."
Hilo turned his hands up and gestured magnanimously around the disordered warehouse.
"Obu, Een, and Make Tar will come back expecting news, but you won't see me again so long as you don't cause any more trouble in No Peak territory. What you do or take from across the border, however, in Fishtown or the Stump, that I'm willing to overlook."
There was a pregnant silence, punctuated by murmuring shuffles. The Horn of No Peak had, with certain caveats, essentially given the Chrome Demons a free pass. A reprieve from clan repression and taxation, in exchange for information, and he'd all but encouraged them to wreak havoc in Mountain territory and steal back across to Coinwash without repercussion if they could get away with it. The men in the warehouse shifted with dubious excitement. The Horn must be angry indeed. Clan war might spell opportunity.
"We should agree, Okan,"
one of the younger bikers said in an eager whisper to the leader, who was staunching his bleeding nose with his shirt.
"I'll decide what we do,"
Okan snarled at the youth, evidently trying to reassert his severely diminished authority. He turned back around and frowned fearsomely at the intrusive Greenbones, but did not quite meet their eyes, staring instead at the bag between the Horn's feet. The man had no jade aura, of course, but Hilo could still perceive the tension in him clearly. Humiliation and pain, warring with the growing sullen awareness that he was being offered something he would be deeply foolish to refuse. At last he said,
"So do we get a cut when you take out Tem Ben and the Mountain's people?"
"Don't be ridiculous,"
Hilo said sharply, and the easy manner he'd displayed thus far vanished so quickly that everyone in the warehouse, even Hilo's own people, flinched at the change. That's clan business. You find me Tem and tell me about his activities and connections, but what happens after that is between Greenbones. I'm putting you in a better spot than the Reds or the Seven Ones or any of the other gangs. You abuse my generous nature on No Peak ground, and I'll find out, and gods help you. Now tell me your answer. Okan mumbled.
All right, we understand each other. We agree.
That's yes, call Jen, and kneel when you pledge your word to the horn, you dog, said Mektar angrily.
Hilo thought that last bit was unnecessary. The gang leader was already resentful and cowed enough. And as much as Hilo appreciated the younger Make's fervent nature, Tar's excitable cruelty detracted rather than added to the impact of the horn's words. Hilo said nothing, making a mental note to himself to correct Tar later. Instead, he picked up the canvas bag at his feet and held it back out to Okan with an air of mild ceremony, symbolically restoring enough of the man's lost respect that he was reasonably confident the rest of the gang would abide by the agreement reached tonight. The leader of the Chrome Demons, still seething, knelt in front of Hilo on the concrete floor of the warehouse and raised his hands in a salute. Chapter 16. The Jade Mine. Shay paused to wipe the sweat from her forehead. The Aspenian city of Winton, where she'd attended business school, had been an arid, high-altitude place surrounded by prairie farmland and heavy manufacturing. She'd hated the bitterly cold, howling foreign winters, but now she found the oppressive humidity of Kaycon's mountainous interior difficult to adjust to. Despite the brief downpour the night before, here on the southern side of the island, this was already considered dry season. At the height of the spring blossom rains, torrential downpours washed out the roads and shut down the area entirely. The mine site office was a short but steep walk up a muddy path from where the driver had parked the coughing, rusted truck on a gravel lot next to two dirt-encrusted excavators. Each step in Shay's two-day journey had been taken by progressively slower means. First, the city subway to Grand Island Station, then the long bus ride out of John Loon to the predominantly Abuké town of Pula, then the hired truck, and now the last bit covered on foot, each squelching step taking her a little closer to the source of jade itself. The canopy of green overhead filtered the sunlight that cut through the high branches in bright shafts. The chittering of birds and the occasional hoot of a monkey reminded her of how vibrant and alive the forest was, and despite the fact that her shirt clung unpleasantly to her skin and beads of sweat ran down between her breasts and made her itch, Shay felt happy to have agreed to Lon's request after all. John Loon was a study in contradictions that could befuddle even someone born there, a bubbling dirty stew and a modern glamorous metropolis at the same time. A place overly conscious of trying to be a world-class city, despite being, at its core, a system of clan fiefdoms. Outside the city, though, Kaycon was a lovely island. Shay could see why, in ancient times, foreign sailors had called it the Cursed Beauty. Being up here on the mountain was just the thing she'd needed to remind herself viscerally why she'd returned. There was something special about her home, about being Kekanese, that ran deeper than the unavoidable difficulties of being a call. The mine supervisor's office was a small shack that looked as if it had survived a few landslides and still clung precariously to the mountain by dint of the logs roughly driven into the ground on its downslope side to prop up its tilting walls. Shay knocked on the door. She could hear the rumble of machinery and activity down in the mine pit, so someone must be on duty. She waited, but when no one answered, she opened the door and went straight in. She found the supervisor engrossed in watching a relay ball game on the small black-and-white television in the back room.
He jumped when she walked in.
Who are you?
He shut the television off hastily and looked her up and down in surprise. She guessed he did not get young city women coming up here often, even ones in dirt-caked boots and trousers rolled halfway up their calves. I knocked, but you must not have heard me, Shay said.
Yes, yes, sorry, I'm half deaf, he said. What do you want? Are you with anyone?
He squinted at her suspiciously. It wasn't unheard of for spectacularly unwise thieves to try to steal from the mine site itself. The supervisor glanced at his desk, where, Shay guessed, he kept his gun. I'm here to inspect the operations in your records, Shay explained.
I wasn't told anything about an inspection. Under whose authority are you here?
Under the authority of my brother, Carl Lanchenwan, the Pillar of No Peak. Shay pulled out an envelope and handed it over. The supervisor broke the seal and scanned the letter, frowning. It was written in Lan's hand, signed with his name and his title as a director on the board of the Kakon Jade Alliance, and stamped with the clan's circular insignia in red ink. The supervisor folded the letter and looked up at Shay with grudging politeness.
Very well. What would you like to see, Carl Jen? Miss Carl?
He studied her uncomfortably again, clearly confused that she did not appear to be wearing any jade. Miss Call is fine, she said. If you wouldn't mind taking me out to see the worksite? The supervisor grumbled a little to himself, but ushered her out of the back room into the office proper. He put on a brimmed straw hat and led the way out of the sagging building and down the path that followed the ridge. The noise of the machinery grew louder, drowning out the sounds of the forest. As they walked, Shay felt a flutter of sensation that prickled her skin like a shift in the damp air. It grew stronger with each step she took, until it became an unmistakable tug in the gut, pulling her like a cord through the navel as they emerged from the trees onto a ledge that overlooked the entire stadium-sized pit. Shay let out a soft breath of awe. In the old Abuke myths, Shay remembered Kianla telling her as a child, the first mother goddess, Nimuma, fell into the ocean and perished from exertion after creating the world. Her body became the island of Kakon, and the veins of jade that ran under these mountains were her bones, her green bones. If she imagined it like that, Shay thought, then the scene below was the largest grave-digging operation imaginable. Here, the most valuable and coveted gemstone in the world was exposed to the air and pulled from the earth. From where Shay stood on the ledge, the huge rock-breaking machines and rickety aluminum-roofed buildings were the size of toy models, and the Abuke workers were small figures moving industriously around the hills of debris. The air smelled of diesel exhaust and vibrated with the shrill whine of water-cooled diamond saws cutting into rock. Among the boulders on the ground and in the beds of the enormous flatbed trucks where the muddy gray rocks had been cut apart, she saw the green gleam of raw jade.
"Careful, miss,"
called the supervisor as Shay started down the metal ramp that zigzagged down the side of the pit to the activity below. She put a hand out to grip the railing as the soles of her muddy boots clanged down the latticed steel walk. The supervisor followed after her.
"Stop at the sign, please,"
he shouted over the rumbling noise of trucks and heavy equipment. At the bottom of the second-to-last ramp was a small observation deck and a large mounted sign. "Attention, authorized personnel only beyond this point. This area is hazardous to those with jade sensitivity. Proceed at your own risk." Shay stopped. There was more raw jade here than was properly safe for anyone without immunity to be exposed to. Shay watched the Abuke workers walking on the ground below. They wore hard hats, thick gloves, and muddy canvas pants, but worked bare-chested in the heat. Like their ancestors, only they could safely live deep in the interior of Kakon. In the modern world, the Abuke had carved out their second-class place in society based on their immunity. The scrawny workers down there worked all day, every day, leaning up casually against the huge boulders and touching all that lustrous green without feeling what Shay felt now. The woozy craving in the bottom of her stomach, even deeper and more gnawing than hunger. Deep-seated Kekanese prejudice maintained that the Abuke were an inferior race, but Shay had studied history and science at an Espenian university and knew that belief was erroneous. The Abuke had inhabited Kaikon centuries before the first arrival of settlers from Tun, so in truth, they were the survivors. They lived unaffected by the substance that drove later explorers to murder each other or throw themselves into the sea. Ironic, then, that now the more fortunate Abuke, such as these ones, worked for the Kaikon Jade Alliance, performing back-breaking labor in order to drink and gamble and whore away their earnings during the idle 3-month height of the rainy season, while the less fortunate of their kin squatted in ramshackle huts by the river and dove for runoff. Shay took a few more steps down the catwalk. If she'd been wearing any jade at all, the thrum of energy vibrating through her body would have been too much, overwhelming. The supervisor called.
Miss Cole, did you read the sign?
I'm not going far, she shouted back. What would happen if she ignored him and went up to one of those boulders and placed the flat of her hand on the raw jade? She wondered if it would knock her unconscious or stop her heart. Would she, for an instant, experience a moment of unsurpassed power and clarity that would make her feel like a moth burning in ecstasy in a flame? Or would it have no immediate effect, but tomorrow, or a week, or months from now, would she lose her mind in stages and start cutting herself when the itches came? Pay attention. I'm here as a favor to Lon, and no reason else. Shay pulled a pad of paper and a pen from her canvas rucksack and leaned over the railing, counting the trucks and workers. She made note of how many bulldozers and excavators were on site. Everything seemed to be in working order, nothing unusual or out of place. The men were dark and ropey from hard labor, but they seemed to be healthy, efficient. She turned and made her way back up the ramps, the relieved supervisor tailing her. When they reached the tilting office again, Shay said, I'd like to see the last 2 years' worth of financial records.
The KJA has that all in their files, the supervisor said. You can get copies from the weatherman staff and John Loon. All we have here are original expense reports.
I'd like to see them, please, Shay said. Reluctantly, the man led her back into the room with the television. He opened a closet and turned on a single naked bulb. The closet was packed with cardboard filing boxes, stacked on top of each other and organized by the dates written on them in thick black marker. He cleared the television off the folding table and wiped the layer of dust off its surface with his bare forearm. It left damp streaks.
You can use this table, he offered,
clearly resentful that she would make it impossible for him to sit back down in front of his relay ball game for some time. Thank you, Shay said. Would you please tell the driver of the truck I hired to wait? I may be a few hours. Do you have a copy machine? The man pointed it out to her, then left her alone. Shay could hear him clomping around and turning on the radio in the other room. She found the most recently dated cardboard box, hefted it out of the closet and onto the small table, and opened it. She pulled out the first thick file folder and sat down. Daily production reports. She flipped to an empty page on her pad of paper, then sat down and started to read. This was going to take a while. It felt a little strange to examine the mining of jade with such an analytical detachment. Scanning the dull files, jade mining came off like any other business, one with inputs and outputs, revenue and expenses. There were accounting statements and invoices and purchase orders. No different, really, than anything else that people manufactured and sold. Traditional Abuké folklore connected Jade to the First Mother and the creation of the world. The deists believed that it was a divine gift from the gods, the path to human salvation. Some foreign religions said it was an evil substance from the devil, a belief the Chitaurians had forcibly espoused during their decades of rule. Jade was imbued with so much myth and emotion, so much mystery and power. And yet, here it was. Boring. Something to be dug up, cut up, moved, carved, polished, sold for profit. She made copies of the pages she thought were of importance, then moved on to the next folder. Personnel manifests. She flipped through them. She wondered what exactly she was looking for. Lan had told her to audit the operations, but he hadn't told her precisely what he thought might be out of place. The personnel lists corroborated the rising salary costs. There had been little turnover, but a couple of injuries and a number of new hires. It all seemed very ordinary. Some of the reports used technical terms, acronyms, and abbreviations she wasn't familiar with, but she possessed a solid enough grasp of the Kekanese mining sector to understand most of it. During her last 2 years at the academy, she'd been tutored by Yun Doru, back when the clan had aspirations for her to hold a high post on the business side of No Peak, perhaps even to one day succeed Doru as weatherman. Unlike her brothers, Shay had not had a lot of friends at Kaldu Academy. Of the other female students, the one she was closest to was Juan Piatishan, the talented but shy daughter of a middling lantern man. Paya's mother had died from illness some years ago, and Shay often brought her friend over to the Call House. One day Shay was searching for something, she could not even remember what, when she stumbled upon a manila envelope full of photographs in Doru's desk. Pretty Paya in her underwear. Paya on her hands and knees, wearing a dog collar. Paya naked, legs spread, pale and awkward-looking, eyes moist. Her friend had cried in shame and abject relief when Shay told her never to come back to the house. She begged Shay to understand. She wasn't that kind of girl. She never wanted to do it. But Doru-jen was being so good to her father's business. What could she have said or done? Shay told her grandfather that she would not be tutored by Doru anymore. She'd learn whatever else she needed to about the clan business from the senior luckbringers such as Hame Tumashan, but she would not have anything more to do with the weatherman. "Be reasonable, Shaysa," Kal Sen had said. "Every man has weaknesses. You don't know what they did to Doru-jen during the war. He has never treated you with any disrespect." Years away had not dimmed Shay's loathing of Yun Dorupan. He'd cost her not just a friend, but the once matchless admiration she'd had for her grandfather. Shay rummaged in her sack for a lunch tin, onion buns, shredded vegetables, and a marinated egg from the kitchen of last night's inn, along with a bottle of water. She ate as she continued to peruse documents. The mine's supervisor poked his head into the room to ask how she was doing. Shay said she was doing fine. She'd figured out the filing system now, and was efficiently pulling and copying the monthly financial summaries so she could read them in greater detail later and compare them with the annual KJA statements. Her plan was to rent a room in Pula. That way, she could come back up the mountain if she needed to. Even if she didn't find anything particularly interesting to report back to Lan, she would treat it as a working holiday of sorts, doing something useful while taking the time to relax in the mountains before having to begin her job hunt in earnest. At the very least, she would familiarize herself with the mining operations, and if she could give Lan some advice on how to make improvements, she'd be putting her business degree to some immediate use. She lifted the lid on a new box and opened the next file. Equipment purchase orders. The mine had made several significant capital investments in the past year. Diamond-tipped core drills, heavy hydraulic spreaders, larger capacity trucks, most of it going to new and expanded mine sites. It struck Shay as poor planning to absorb all the cost in a single year. She wondered if the weatherman's office applied any pressure on the KJA to do proper investment appraisals. She wrote, "Capital budgeting?" in her notebook, then pulled another folder she'd marked and checked the financial statements. First-year depreciation on new equipment was indeed driving most of the rise in operating expenses. Mine production was up 15% over last year, though the increase hadn't been realized as revenue yet. Perhaps the KJA was holding all that extra jade in inventory. The cartel kept strict control over how much jade was allotted to Greenbone schools, deities' temples, and other licensed users in the military or healthcare fields, and how much was sold, primarily to the Aspenian government. The rest was kept locked away in a massive national vault underneath the Kaycon Treasury building. Shay's eyes skipped over the equipment purchase order pages one more time. Her gaze landed on the signature at the bottom. It was not one she had seen anywhere else in the files. She studied it for a second before she realized whose name it was. Gaunt Ashantu, the Horn of the Mountain. Why would the leader of the military arm of the Ait clan be signing mining equipment purchase orders? Although the Greenbone clans were controlling stakeholders of the KJA, the mines themselves were state-operated, not managed by the clans directly. The annual budget for the mine's operations was approved by the KJA board, so any signature on this form ought to be from a representative that sat on or answered to the board. Either Doru, or Re-Tura, the weatherman of the mountain, or one of their direct subordinates. What could it mean that Gaunt's signature was on this page, and several others? Shay copied all the pages and tucked them carefully into her bag. She replaced the files, put the box back into the closet, and left the room. She wouldn't be staying in Pula tonight after all. She had a long trip back to the city and needed to get on the road as quickly as possible. Chapter 17. Night at the Lilac Divine. The charm girl's voice was exquisite, by turns operatically high and pure, then sultry and suggestive. She played the tuny harp and sang with eyes closed, her dainty head and waves of dark hair swaying to the melody. Resting on the plush cushions, Lan let the tension drop out of his shoulders and his mind fall quietly into the music. He was the only one in the opulent room. This was a private performance. The song was about a lost traveler missing his island home. No one here would have the poor tact to sing him lyrics about love or heartbreak. Lan was accustomed to traveling with one or two bodyguards, but he came to the Lilac Divine Gentlemen's Club alone. He wanted to enjoy himself without being tailed by anyone else in the clan. While he was here, he didn't want to think about being the pillar. Mrs. Sugo, the Lantern Man owner of the Lilac Divine, was appreciative of that fact and could be counted on for her discretion as well as her excellent taste. There was never any trouble at this place either. Everyone knew it was a no-peak frequented establishment, and a person would have to be suicidal to cause problems, even if the gambling downstairs got out of hand. Greenbones could take credit for certain things, Lon figured. On the whole, John Loon was one of the safest cities in the world. The clans kept out foreign criminals and gangsters, stamped down street crime, and taxed and controlled vice at a level acceptable to the politicians and the public. If some of Mrs. Sugo's late-night offerings were not entirely legal, she had the good sense to make her clan tribute payments timely and generous, and to spare no effort in making Lon's visits enjoyable. Yuni, the charm girl, stretched out the last melancholy note of the song, her throat vibrating as her fingers danced lightly across the harp strings. Lan set down his wine glass and applauded. Yuni ducked her chin with false shyness, looking up at him through dusted eyelashes.
Did you enjoy that one, Lan Zhen?
Very much so. It was beautiful. She started to stand and let the silk scarf fall from her shoulders, but Lan said, Do you have another song? She sat back down gracefully.
Something a little more cheerful, perhaps?
She plucked at the strings and launched into a light-hearted ballad. Lan rested his eyes on the curve of her neck and the plump red gloss of her moving lips. He admired the way her gauzy dress hung off the slopes of her breasts and pale thighs. It was getting easier to work himself up to being with her. As Pillar, he could have any of the girls here, more than one at a time if he wanted. But the first few times he'd come, after he'd accepted that Amy was gone for good, all he'd asked for was to sit and listen to Yuni sing. He'd told himself he didn't want sex, just an escape, just company. He shuddered at the sorts of places Doru had attempted to suggest to him on a few occasions. But Yuni was easy to talk to, and beautiful in both voice and body. She was neither overly deferential nor too eager to please. She conversed with him about music and foreign films, but never asked him to say anything about the clan or its affairs. When he did finally take her to bed, he found her pleasing and energetic. Tonight, though, he found it harder than usual to forget his worries. There had been no further communication between the clans for over 2 months, but Lan knew that Ait could read his actions clearly enough. He'd declined the Mountain's proposal to join forces in producing SN1. He'd set Chancellor Sohn to proposing KJA reforms, and instead of removing Hilo, he'd allowed his brother to bolster clan presence along all territorial borders. He believed he'd acted correctly in each case, but Lan knew he was walking a perilous line, particularly with the latter decision. Just last week, there'd been a spate of motorcycle gang violence between Coinwash and Fishtown, enough to garner a short mention in the news, which was saying something, as both neighborhoods were such crowded, destitute slums that a few killings there would normally never merit attention. Greenbones were not directly involved, so neither clan could claim offense. But everyone knew the horns on both sides of the border not only kept the criminal class in line, but manipulated it as well. Lan worried that it would only take one Greenbone or Lantern Man being caught or implicated in a violent incident for it to escalate to something that openly involved the clans themselves. Lan knew his brother well. Subtlety was not in Hilo's nature. He respected clan hierarchy too much to ever disobey the Pillar on important matters, but he had complete day-to-day authority over the clan's activities on the streets, and his personal code was to leave no doubt that he would go further than his enemies if wronged. A look would be returned with a word with a blow with a beating with an execution. Perhaps it would be better to have a horn that was more prudent and restrained, who wouldn't raise overflowing tensions even further. However, alienating his brother might be the worst possible decision. There was no one who could, or would, step in to fill Hilo's role. The Fists of No Peak, and by extension the Fingers, weren't just loyal to the clan, or to the office of the Horn. They were loyal to call Hilo. It disturbed Lan far more than he cared to admit that, if forced to choose between him and Hilo, many of the Greenbone warriors in the clan might side with his younger brother. By demanding that he replace his horn as a condition for future negotiation, Ait was asking him to knowingly weaken and sow dissent within his own clan. She was placing him in a dilemma that held all the makings of a trap.
You look as if you could use a massage.
Yuni had finished playing her song and had come to sit beside him. Lan had barely noticed. I'm sorry, he said. I know I seem distracted.
You have a lot on your mind, she said kindly. He appreciated her patient acceptance. It was something Amy had not been willing to give.
He ran a hand down her long, sleek hair and brought some of it to his face, enjoying the feel and smell of it as she unbuttoned his shirt and drew it over his shoulders.
Wait, he said.
He stood up and went to the dresser in the corner of the room. In the mirror, under the dim red lighting, he saw himself, bare-chested, and wondered if he really could live up to being the person he appeared to be. A strong, assured man, a hard-bodied green-bone warrior, a leader adorned in jade, a man like his father.
Lon took off his jade-studded belt and the cuffs on his forearms, leaving on only the beads he wore on a chain around his neck. He shut his belt and cuffs in the safe below the dresser and turned the combination lock. Yuni claimed she was half Abuke, nearly a Stone Eye, but he removed most of his jade out of consideration for her anyway, just to be safe. In truth, after the initial disorienting few minutes of withdrawal, he found it strangely relaxing to be without all his jade. His surroundings became a little foggy and soft around the edges. With his senses dimmed, he felt as if he was making love in a dark room, in a pleasant dream perhaps, and could just let himself act without seeing too clearly, without thinking too much. He felt more detached, more serene. He wondered if this made him unusual among Greenbones. Hilo, after all, studded jade into his body so it could never be removed. Shay had gone too far in the other direction. Lon wondered how she could stand it, being jadeless. That was another thing troubling him tonight. Last month, Shay had gone to the mines as he'd asked, and phoned from Pula to tell him that Gaunt Ash was ordering equipment purchases at the mines. Neither of them knew what to make of it. Did it mean Gaunt was usurping Re-Tura's authority? 3 weeks had passed before she'd phoned him again. It was as Lon had feared.
I've gone through the numbers over and over, and it looks as though the equipment purchases Gaunt approved aren't being reflected in the KJA's financial statements, Shay told him. The Mountain has been getting involved in the mines directly without consulting the board of the KJA.
Shay said she was going to the KCON Treasury to examine its records. She'd get back to him soon. He'd been highly reluctant to pull Shay into the clan business, but now he knew it had been worthwhile. Shay had verified his mounting suspicions that Ait Mata had been a step ahead of his meeting with Chancellor Son, and had already begun to try to wrest greater control over the country's jade supply. In addition, Lon was now convinced he could not rely on Doru. There was no excuse for the weatherman to not be aware of such information, or to keep it from him. If he confronted the old advisor, he was sure Doru would deny any subterfuge or negligence, give him some reasonable explanation, and go to call Sen for support. No, he needed solid evidence to justify not just removing the man from his post, but from the inner circle. Woon would have to be ready to take over immediately and completely, with no transition. That was another reason he couldn't demote Hilo. The clan couldn't be without a veteran weatherman and a horn at the same time. So many problems. Yuni led him to the bed, undressed him completely, and guided him down onto his stomach. He closed his eyes as she rubbed his back with scented oil.
You're tense, she said soothingly, working her thumbs into the muscles of his neck. Perhaps from carrying so much jade.
The pillow under Lan's face hid the twist of his lips. The charm girls here knew a few things about Greenbones and how to flatter them. Even the ones who wore the most jade were insecure about their power. Everyone's tolerance was different, though. Lon carried a considerable amount of jade by the standards of any respectable greenbone, but he felt no desire to press his limits. Beyond a certain point, additional jade made him feel off-kilter, wired, moody. The problem was, although the role of pillar was about far more than how much green a man displayed, people were superficial. According to old-timers, the great Khaldu had carried more jade than any other warrior in his day. When his son's rival, a woman pillar, showed off conspicuously more green, it was talked about. It was whispered as if it was a personal failing. Yuni massaged down to his waist. She spread warm oil on her hands and forearms and slid them up and down his body. She reached and stroked between his legs. He wasn't sure at what point her dress came off, but he felt her bare breasts rubbing against his back, her long hair trailing against his skin as she glided herself up and down slowly and sensually against him. When she turned him over and straddled him upside down, her bare stomach and crotch over his face, every troubled thought finally exited Lon's mind. He lifted his head to drink in her odor as she worked her elegant harpist's hands over his chest, stomach, pelvis, and inner thighs. He was truly impressed by how many skills she possessed. For a few seconds, he thought of Aini and missed her bitterly, but the emotion was fleeting, made dull by familiarity. His arousal flagged only briefly, returning once Yuni's hands and mouth began their masterful and exciting ministrations, and when he felt close to climax, he asked her to lie down. Yuni moaned and sighed, and whispered, "Ah, yes, this is what I want," grabbing his hips as he took her. He came faster than he'd expected, then sagged, everything leaving him, as he rolled off her and sank into the soft mattress. Yuni brought a warm, moist towel and rubbed his face and neck and chest. "You can stay as long as you like," she cooed. He knew that was not true, but out of all the lies he had to deal with, Yuni's were the most innocuous and easy to swallow. He was pleased that she seemed to enjoy their time together. Even if it was a skillful artifice, he appreciated it. Out of habit, he closed one hand over his jade beads as the room dissolved, and he began to drift off. There was a knock at the door. Lon wasn't sure he'd heard correctly. No one ever interrupted him here. Yuni frowned in disapproval and sat up, reaching for a robe to cover herself. She started to get up and go to the door, but Lon stopped her. "Who is it?" he called.
"Call Jen,"
came Mrs. Sugo's voice, sounding high and apprehensive through the door.
"Please forgive me for disturbing you. I would normally never, but there is someone from the clan here for you. It's very urgent."
Lon pushed off the bed and put on his pants.
"Stay here," he said to Yuni,
then went to the safe and tried the combination twice before the lock popped open. He put on his belt and jade cuffs, then clutched the edge of the dresser with both hands as the energy surge hit him, flooding into his system. Everything swam, then sharpened. Noise and vision and feeling blasted into his skull. He breathed deeply through the adjustment, then straightened. He glanced at himself in the mirror again, shirtless, but with every pebble of jade in place. He walked to the door and opened it. Mrs. Sugo backed out of his way, white-faced. Behind her stood Mate Ken, breathing hard, enraged, his tan jacket splattered with blood that was not his own.
"The mountain did it," he gasped. "They whispered Hilo's name."
First Interlude. Heaven and Earth. Long ago in heaven, according to Deitus' teachings, the great extended family of gods lived in dazzling palaces of jade. Like any large family, the gods had their share of quarrels, but for the most part, they went about their immortal lives happily, although once they had children, and those children had children, residential space in heaven grew too tight for comfort. So the gods constructed a second home, which they modeled after their first and called Earth. Earth was, at first, in every way as beautiful as heaven, with vast seas, high mountains, lush forests, and countless wondrous plants and animals. Unfortunately, the numerous children of the gods, having grown up spoiled, fell to squabbling over Earth even before it was completed. Several wanted the same ocean. Others bickered over who would take the highest mountain range or the biggest continent. At last, the fighting grew so constant and unbearable that the godparents grew enraged. "We built a perfect home for you, and this is how you repay us, by spoiling it with pettiness, greed, and jealousy, turning brother against brother, sister against sister. Have Earth, then, but suffer for it, as you'll have nothing else from us." And the parents stripped their children of their divine powers, made them small and weak and naked, and exiled them from heaven. Yato, the father of all, blasted to shards the first and only half-constructed jade palace on Earth, and buried under it a mountainous island. The gods, though, being parents, could not resist keeping an eye on their struggling, estranged children. Some, like Thana, the moon, or Poya, the goddess of agriculture, took pity on their descendants and hovered close, helping to light their way at night or ensuring they had food to eat. Others, like Yofo, the typhoon god, or Sagi, the pestilence, refused to give up their grudges, and unless placated, would descend on occasion to remind humanity of its long-standing offenses. All earthly conflict, so the deist philosophers say, stems from the original offense of the children against their parents and of siblings against one another. All human progress and virtuous striving is likewise an attempt to achieve familial forgiveness and a return to the spiritually and physically divine state, which lies latent but distantly remembered. Chapter 18. The Whispered Name. A frantic call had come earlier in the evening from Mr. Pack, who, along with his wife, had run a grocery store in the armpit for 12 years. "I have to go," Hilo said to Wen after he hung up the phone. He was frustrated because she refused to move out of her cramped apartment in Pawpaw and live with him in the Horns' residence on the Call estate unless they were married. "I have to ask Lon properly, and then we'll plan the wedding, and it'll take months," he'd argued. "Things are getting worse between the clans. I visit here too often. It's not safe for you." Wen's apartment building was only a street over from Coinwash, which had seen a recent surge in violent crime. Even within No Peak territory, Hilo was not willing to take any chances with Wen's safety. He would not put it past the mountain to circumvent Aisho and engineer some unfortunate accident if they knew they could further provoke him. "If you won't be reasonable, I'll have to post fingers to watch over you, which means fingers that I won't have elsewhere. The house is secure. Bigger, too. You can fix it up. You're good at that. You'd like it." Wen folded her arms and gazed at him with immovability. "I'm not going to give your family any additional reasons to look down on me. We'll live together when we're married and not before. In the meantime, I have a gun, and I know how to use it. I won't be a burden. I can take care of myself."
"A gun?" Hilo gave an ugly laugh. "Is that supposed to reassure me?
My enemies are green bones. You're a stone eye." "Thank you for the reminder," she said coolly.
On the street outside, Ken honked the horn of the Duchess, and Hilo growled,
"We'll talk about this later."
When he arrived at the grocer's with the makes, he found Mr. Pack sitting on the sidewalk with his head in his hands and Mrs. Pack crying as she swept up broken glass inside. Two young men with jade studs in their eyebrows had smashed the windows, broken the neon sign over the door, and knocked over several shelves of merchandise as punishment for the couple's failure to pay tribute to the Mountain Clan. Hilo scowled as he surveyed the wreckage, his mood worsening. Nothing was stolen, but incidents like these were costing No Peak dearly, not just in money to take care of the damages, but in goodwill from the lantern men in the district.
"I can't pay tribute to two clans," Mr. Pack moaned.
"We'll take care of it," said Hilo. "It won't happen again."
Later, there was some question as to whether the Packs had been turned by the Mountain and were in on the plot. When Mr. Pack learned of what happened, he cut off his own ear to proclaim his innocence and threw himself on the mercy of Kaal Lan. The couple's home and store were searched, and they were cleared of suspicion. But 2 months later, the Packs shut down their store and moved out of the armpit for good. On that night, however, Hilo had his fingers ask questions until he learned that the two men who'd vandalized the grocery were Yen Io and Chan Dal, and they could be found at an all-night arcade on a busy commercial strip of the armpit. For smaller transgressions, Hilo would have sent one of his fists and a couple of fingers, but he was sick and tired of Lan's restraint and the bullshit situation in the armpit. People needed to know No Peak was strong here and would not be trifled with. Vibrant, noisy, colorful, and seedy, the armpit was one of John Moon's most valuable districts. By day, it attracted tourists and shoppers. After dark, both stockbrokers and dock workers mingled in its streets, entertaining themselves with the myriad of restaurants, gambling dens, bars, strip clubs, and theaters. No Peak could not afford to lose ground here. Hilo decided it was necessary that he handle this offense personally. The Pillar had ordered him not to take lives, but that didn't mean he couldn't make a public statement. They parked in a pay lot down the street from the Superjoy Arcade. Ken was suffering from a sinus headache and was blowing his nose into a soggy handkerchief. The Elder Make brother had had his cheekbone fractured in his teens, and ever since then had a difficult time on days when the pollution and humidity in John Loon were high.
"Stay in the car," Hilo told him. "Tar and I won't be long."
Ken agreed readily, turning on the radio and lighting a smoke as Hilo and Tar got out and walked down the sidewalk toward the Superjoy. Ken being left behind in the car was what saved the Horn's life. As Hilo and Tar crossed the street, two men raced up on motorcycles. As they roared past the Duchesse, Ken understood in an instant what was happening. He shouted out in warning and laid hard on the Duchesse's horn. It was not the blare of noise, however, but the surge of Ken's visceral alarm that reached Hilo first, a fraction of a second before he perceived the murderous intent of the assassins as they opened fire with handguns. One bullet tore the shoulder of Hilo's jacket, and another whined past his ear as he fell to a crouch and threw up a wall of deflection that veered the shots to either side around him. They punched into car doors and the walls of nearby buildings. Screams erupted as people ran from the scene, pushing and shoving each other to get away. The salvo of gunfire was just an opening, meant to stun. Both the attackers leapt, light, from the backs of their motorcycles, as Yen Io and Chan Dal appeared from the parked car where they had been lying in ambush. Hilo rose, talon knife in a fighting grip. Jade energy surged alongside adrenaline. The two men flew straight at him, moon blades cutting down in vicious arcs. Hilo slid aside and slammed his crossed wrists into one man's upraised arm, cleaving into it with his talon knife. Redirecting the momentum of his opponent's moonblade, he pivoted out of the way and sent the man stumbling forward as he jerked the talon knife across the elbow, severing tendons. The second man's moon blade slashed across Hilo's midsection. He barely had time to focus his steel as he